So today we'll be talking about marine use planning, and I'll draw upon an example out of Kakatla Nation on the north coast of British Columbia, who have been engaged as a community in the process in a variety of different planning processes. This emblem here is the emblem that the Kakatla Environmental Monitoring Agency uses, which shows crests of the four clans. We have raven, wolf, blackfish, and eagle. It's eagle, wolf, blackfish, and raven, in that order. Blackfish, you know what blackfish is? Sorry? An orca? Yes, orca or killer whale. Yeah. More commonly, anyway, blackfish. So, rough agenda. Some of these things we'll skim over more quickly than others. Take a little bit of look at the timeline of marine planning in Kakatla, some of the resource management use within Kakatla perspective. PENSEMA, anyone heard the acronym? Well, you may have heard of it, but maybe you don't know. PENSEMA. We'll talk about PENSEMA. This world of applied work is filled with acronyms and abbreviations that we use without thinking about it. Kakatla Marine Plan, which is what the MAP process, marine planning process, is linked to. And then some of the ideas looking at marine planning and Kakatla sovereignty. Some of these blend in together, but those are the general themes and topics that we'll look at in this discussion. Part of what we're trying to ask is, what are the mechanisms or possibilities for enacting sovereignty, for actually trying to deploy the strategic value of rights and title within the current context? And there are some possibilities, but there's an awful lot of obstacles to doing these things, or at least, and very often, when they're done, they are totally understood differently by the signatories of the agreement. Yes? Oh, the health sector. Yeah. Right. So, this is a classic case. So the example, what's going on, we have the commercial roe herring fishery is currently underway. It began late February, early March in the Gulf, and then it's continued forward. There have been three nations that have tried court actions to stop the herring fishery. The Haida this time were the only ones who were successful with their injunction. On the west coast, the Tsleil-Waututh weren't successful, and the Heiltsuk, I'm trying to remember if they actually did an injunction or they just tried to declare it closed. But anyway, they weren't successful. This shows that even though there are consultative processes where First Nations are engaged back and forward with the Crown reserves the ultimate right to make the decision. Now, there aren't that many herring seiners up there. I looked at the number of distribution because my father still has a commercial herring seine license, which he leases. Of course, the current going rate to lease a herring seine license these days is for the cost of the fees. It used to be those licenses could have been leased for $150,000 to $250,000 a use. It's going back about 25, 30 years, and then it's really declined. So what the companies would do is say, we will pay your fees for the license, which are about $3,500. We will pay your fees and get to use your license, but that's it, nothing more. And then the way the herring seine fishery works these days, they're basically doing pool type operations. Everyone shares the fisheries, and there's so many tons per license. About 180 of these licenses. Same licenses were located in the Gulf here, Gulf of Georgia. Though I know on charts they used to call it the Strait of Georgia or Georgia Straits. I grew up calling it the Gulf. I guess I could call it the Salish Gulf as opposed to the Salish Sea. I mean, I find it's not a sea, it's not a strait, but then the oceanographers tell me that it's not a gulf either. Anyway, that's a mere side point. Up in the central area, I don't believe there's more than a dozen or so licenses. So there's not really a large operation. On the Haida Gwaii Islands, I think there was about two or three licenses at all had chosen. The west coast of Vancouver Island had, I think, another dozen or so licenses assigned there. And that fishery, they basically haven't been able to find the fish, from what best I've heard, in the west coast as of yet anyway. And then there's about three or four boats in the north coast, which is a big bay, which is just out below Port Simpson for gonets, and Kakatla Inlet for the herring seines. And there's about two or three boats there. Kakatla, several years, a decade or two ago, tried to stop the herring fishery in the inlet too, to no avail. But at the end of the day, what happens is that the Crown asserts its total and supreme sovereignty. And that's what's happening in this case. And so the only way the Heltzik could actually, under Canadian law, push this issue is to actually then try to end up in court defining that they have a title fishery for roe herring. And they did a few years ago with the Gladstone case, determine that they, in the mid-90s, where a couple of gentlemen, one of whose last name was Gladstone, brought a couple tons of roe and kelp down to Vancouver and tried to sell it to a guy, to a company. But the company says, we're not going to buy it from you. And they walked outside the door and the DFO arrested them for attempt to sale fish, which then turned into a major court win for the Heltzik, in which the Heltzik had the legal right to harvest and market roe on kelp. It didn't really affect the what's sometimes by the biologists called sack roe fishery, or more in the fishery, a lot of people just typically call it roe fishery, the herring roe fishery. So unless the Heltzik actually take them directly to court for a title fishery or a rights-based fishery, we're going to still have this kind of problem using the courts. The other method, which they try to just declare a closure and then try to enforce it, the question becomes whether anybody actually fished it. Of course, it's like the old days when they used to have strikes in the industry and strike, and the union tried to close things. There almost inevitably was one group of fishermen who would keep fishing anyway, though it'd be a minority. So it would be interesting to say how it actually pans out. But that's the point. They might declare it, but legally in the courts, they'd have to go, it'd take a few years. They probably would find a herring fishery, potentially. The thing is that the roe and kelp one, or the herring spawn fisheries, are well documented within the ethnographic literature and the historical literature of there being indigenous harvests of herring and trade in herring eggs. The herring itself, surprisingly, doesn't have the same record, though when you look at the archaeological remains in village sites, herring is as ubiquitous in the physical record as is salmon. So, well, that doesn't tell you how many salmon or how many herring were caught, but it tells you when you just measure the bones that are left in that soil, you've got one-third salmon, one-third herring, one-third other stuff, which is a real diverse thing. So that says that herring was being harvested for the flesh, but somewhere in the early 1800s, mid-1800s, people stopped actually, in the indigenous communities, people stopped actually harvesting herring for the flesh, but continued harvesting for the roe. So that's what's happening there. The marine plan, this speaks directly to this because it's one of the primary contradictions in marine planning comes with who actually has the jurisdiction. And this actually does speak to one of the things. You go back even to the early period of the early 1900s when you have drag seine licenses being issued by the provincial government because they're shore-based sites. You find that the companies and the settler industries consider that they're running the fishery, but almost to the letter, where you have a drag seine fishery for salmon on this coast, it's being operated by the hereditary chief and house group that's associated with that fishing site. So you get this very interesting amalgam. So from within the indigenous community, it's being operated according to customary and traditional protocols and who has the hereditary rights. According to the Crown and the Canadian and British Columbian system, it's being operated according to Crown law, Crown rules with Crown authorities. So it's a kind of interesting dynamic. And as long as these systems don't come into conflict, they sort of persist. And so it's a funny deal. And every now and again, there's a conflict or something bumps up that raises this paradox is brought to light. Now this map is Kakatla's asserted traditional territory. If I were to lay on the map of, say, Kitisou down the bottom here, it would look a little bit different down the bottom. Hartley Bay is up in here somewhere. Haisla comes down here. The actual core area, if you look at what would not be a total overlap from other claims in Kekatla, would involve this island here, with, except for a tiny little chunk up by the arrow, this entire island here, this entire island here, half of this island, and then some cut through here, and a bit of quibbles over which side of Granville Channel, which is here, the territory is. The oral histories and narratives connect, which is part of this issue, connect the Kekatla up into these different areas. There's also, what's not shown in this map, up in the Nass River, which won't go on this map, is the Ulican fishing site that belonged to one of the leading blackfish communities. But there are overlaps and differences of opinion. This line niche out here, if it's the same one originally, was the result of a memorandum of understanding signed between the Simpson Tribal Council and the Council of the Haida Nation somewhere in the mid-late 90s. And I think that still follows that line. So just this is sort of give a sense of what's going on with this. And this is just the last, you can see, 5 years, essentially, in terms of planning. There's been a whole range of attempts at planning of different sorts. But prior to this current decade, most of the planning that's taken place has been land-based planning attempts. And most of that was kick-started by the Clackwit protests in the 1990s. And those were over logging issues. The then NDP provincial government set up a massive scientific panel to review after they arrested close to 1,000 people for protesting the harvesting of old growth timber. And in the ensuing period of time, they created this massively expensive and time-consuming process to review Clackwit Sound from scientific, social, cultural values and trying to come up with a land use planning process. Out of that experience, they said, okay, this is, and there's a number of different acronyms that got tied to these processes, but the time you come to the end of the 90s, they said, okay, we need to find something that will work, that will be relatively more expedient, and resolve, you know, bring all the different quote-unquote stakeholders to the table. And then you created the LRMP, Land Resource Management Planning Process, which was, again, all on land, about zoning land. And it was all framed by a standard planner's model, trying to tie into so-called adaptive management and ecosystem-based management models. We won't go over what they are. And they also limited stakeholders to particular official delegations, which then became a problem with First Nations. So they might limit the outfitter tourism sector to 2 representatives, but they wouldn't restrict the First Nations to 2 because, of course, each First Nation says, we are an autonomous government. So you'd have a representative from each First Nation. These were consensus-making driven processes as opposed to majority rule, but ultimately the government, the minister, had to sign off on the deals. In the marine space, which is federal, the federal government has always said it had a system of advisory panels for regulating, in which they always included essentially a kind of tripartite system of representation. Recreational, which increasingly over the 20th century became essentially the commercial sport fishing sector. The people who were actually, who if you go down to South Terminal and in the summer in the commercial sport fishing season, those are the guys who are funding all the float planes up the mid-coast, west coast Vancouver Island, north end of Queen Charlotte's, Haida Gwaii, etc. And you see the boxes of fish flying through in St. John's, cannery processing right there, and a few other little boutique fish processing and freezing facilities. Commercial sport sector. Then you had the commercial fishing sector, the quote-unquote traditional commercial fish sector, typically represented by a combination of industry and, i.e., the people who ran the fish companies, and boat owners. At various points in time, there have been representatives of the crew through the fishermen's trade union, but essentially DFO restricted it to license holders. License holders and the people who ran the processing firms. And then the third group represented were Aboriginal fishing interests, which over time became coalesced into particular agencies through the different province-wide organizations. And this represents the way in which the catch, especially since 1996 when the Sparrow decision, the court decision, came down, which allocated the priority of use. Environmental concern first, Aboriginal food, social, ceremonial, commercial, and then recreational, and then, well, that was deemed to be covering it all. But basically from fairly well established, almost by the 30s, you had these advisory panels set up. Of course, the Crown reserved the right to make the decisions in fisheries. And you don't start seeing official planning until we get the PENCIMA, with the Pacific North Coast Integrated Management Area planning process. And this is linked to Canadian federal legislation, the Ocean Strategy, which is called the Canada Ocean Strategy. The act of legislation that got passed somewhere in the preceding decade, late 90s, early 2000s, I forget exactly when it was produced, to move the planning of the large ocean bodies to these kind of large aggregate zones to try to coordinate all the different stakeholders and meet the variety of different needs. Also linked to some of the international treaties Canada has signed. So the marine planning really didn't kick off until, it was around the late 2000, this decade, but a little bit earlier, 2013 is when it starts really rolling forward. LOMA is Large Ocean Management Area. All of these things, that's LOMA. And then, we'll talk a little bit about this and move to the marine area planning process, which is ironic's not the right word for this, but it's a little bit strange because it's a provincial initiative, and the province has no authority over marine use. So the province is started to initiate in 2014 a marine planning process tied to a First Nations province provincial agreement partnership. And they're trying to backfill in the absence of the federal government. And we'll talk a little bit about that when I get back to PENCIMA. So this is the kind of overview. The marine planning part is relatively recent in terms of the federal and provincial government in this process. As I said, it was mostly land-based planning that was going on prior to this. Now, it's important to understand how Kakatla sees, and much like many other coastal First Nation, how that nation sees its resource management rights, privileges, and protocols. And first off, it seemed to be a rights-based axis. And here, we're not actually talking about Aboriginal rights entitled under Canadian law. The idea of rights is that your right to access comes through your membership in the community, in a particular house group that has access to a particular territory. So that's the notion, this particular notion of rights-based. The harvest is controlled. It wasn't just an open access, free-for-all kind of harvesting. That you just couldn't go, and if you go back to the way it's perceived today, but back historically, you couldn't just go into somebody else's territory and catch fish. Right from the very first time Kakatla started to meet with newcomers coming into the territories, the conflict was over them catching fish and not paying attention. So when James Colnett came in the 1787, started harvesting fish, he said, breaking up stone traps and harvesting devices, the Kakatla people said, you can't do this. Let's explain the way the rules work. And eventually turned to a modest form of open conflict. All the way along, one of the current and persistent irritations that occur in the community is with external users coming in and harvesting fish recreationally or commercially or in any other way without asking for permission. And of course that creates a real sense of indignation and annoyance and anger, because of course there's people who are coming in, like sports fishermen, catching fish, they actually believe they have a God-given right to do that. It's always an interesting experience to be on the Kakatla monitoring vessel and come alongside a recreational sport fisherman. They get really uptight, most of them, about the whole idea. And you can see there's really, it seems to be an underlying sense that the Tekakwitha has no right to even ask them why they are there. There's a lot of guardian-type programs and monitoring programs up and down the coast being operated by First Nations, and very often the practice is, because there's no direct capacity under Canadian law to control what's happening, but there is the right to ask questions, collect information, and monitor what's happening. And that kind of creates a real sense of unease about the people being monitored. Cast yourself in the mind, what's it like going through a customs guard or a security gate in an airport? Unless you're a very unique person, I doubt you find it a pleasurable experience. I could be wrong. I never find it pleasurable. I always find it an intrusion. And this is, in a sense, a similar way, where here I'm at least accepting the right of the people to interrogate me and to surveil me as I cross to the borderline. Imagine now you do not believe the people have a right to interrogate, question, or monitor you. How that must feel to be then experienced to them. Tied with this kind of harvest was a habitat stewardship, where there was direct maintenance, and a lot of the research that we've done is focused upon the mechanisms and techniques people use to maintain, cultivate, and actually augment biological production in these zones. So if you do certain things to berry patches, you will augment the berry crops in pursuing years by the way you harvest them, the way you prune them, the way you might even feed them with fish remains, things like that. In terms of salmon creeks and streams, by shaping them, putting particular barriers, moving certain types of debris, putting blockages and stone structures in other places, you change and augment the fishery. And even by regulating the harvest in a particular way, you can stabilize over the long haul fisheries. There's a notion of need-based harvest. Now, need's always a tricky thing to explain, because need is a socially defined concept. And one of the tricky things is how you navigate this concept of need forward into a market economy. Because one of the things that a market economy does, it destroys the social constraints on need. Need in a capitalist market economy is insatiable. It's constantly expanding. It's never resolved. And you have to physically act against it. And the whole system drives counter. So there's a problem. That is one of the difficulties. Oftentimes, need, in terms of the need to catch more, do more, make more, gets restrained by inability or inefficiency or regulations. Now, prior to this being a capitalist economy here, the indigenous economy was a wealth-generating economy. It did engage in trade. People engaged in trade in exchange for benefit. But there was a different dynamic to the economic system that caused it to operate differently than a capitalist system did. Part of the way need was calculated is tied to this idea of community-based distribution, where resources are shared in a particular way, not equally. It wasn't that story in the New Testament of Acts, where all the believers came together and they're all supposed to put everything in the pool and divide it all up equally. And I don't know, people probably don't. See, it comes from having gone to Sunday school. Whether you wanted to or not, you remember these stories because they're the interesting thing. And then there was this one couple who hoarded and kept back, and Peter called them out and basically said, "You guys are actually you're not following the rules." And then that was it. They were struck dead. And that was the lesson. Everyone has to share and share alike. It wasn't quite an equal sharing, but there was a very clear distributional sense of how things were allocated through different family lines and across lines. One of the ways this is manifest today is when you have large community events and large food, there's always way more food than would be eaten at that particular event. And part of this becomes a very public and polite way of distributing food to people without actually making it charity. It's a right when you go to a special smorgasbord or a feast or a banquet to come with your Tupperware containers and leave. There's one particular funny story that was told about this one company that came in and they ordered Chinese food, and they thought they'd ordered enough and there was nothing left, because people thought these guys were really shiftless for not having enough of the food brought in for this luncheon they put on. Of course, the guys who were running it didn't realize what part of what they needed to do is they had to have so much there that there would be actually leftovers, more than leftovers, that people wouldn't be able to take it all away and they'd be left with stuff continue. So, I mean, it serves as a distributive mechanism in one sense, and that's one of the kind of contemporary model of that. The other notion here, some of the principles, that there was often targeted or species-specific harvesting. So it wasn't traditionally an opportunistic harvesting where if you see something, you grab it. It was one would prepare or orient to the particular item that you're going. It doesn't mean you were restricted to, say, one type of animal. It would be in the context in which these existed. So there might be an assembly of things or a sort of a suite of things that were all harvested around the same time or interconnected or interlinkages. But it wasn't just a kind of gratuitous trundling along the waterways of the landscape and picking things up here and there that turned up. It was a deliberative, controlled, targeted process. And then one final really important thing is that we have a system of tideline conservation. Now, it doesn't mean that people didn't go below the low tideline mark, but there's an interesting way in which the physical constraints of the environment limited people's harvesting. Abalone, for example, were basically only harvested at the very, very low zero tide. There are the trap mechanism that was developed where you take a seal skin and turn it flesh side out, and at the very, very low tide, you try to get it down even a bit lower if you could below the tide, weight it down with rocks, and then the tide would come in, tide would go out, and that would attract abalone. And then they harvest that sap. So that would allow you to extend your reach, but you weren't, of course, diving. You weren't putting scuba tanks on going under. There are some examples of dentalia harvesting where people use these long, on the west, I believe the west coast of Vancouver Island, these long kind of dredge-type devices to reach down to get into this, to get the dentalia shells out of the bottom. So they are extending below the tide line, but they're going off to these beaches. But by and large, most of harvesting was restrained by tidal action, tidal line, and that was where the harvesting the marine resource for fixed shellfish type things were stopped. Other types of mobile fish were, you did move into the waterway with hook and lines, nets, and traps. These are sea urchin. Quite tasty. Has anyone had sea urchin? Gee. Yeah, this is the moment which I really wish I could bring some sea urchin into the class. I mean, it would be it's very much like butter. You just eat the kind of the gonads or the egg type portion on them, and they kind of yellowy, buttery. Crack them open, split them out. They're best when had fresh. This is seaweed being dried. It's been harvested and then brought into the village. Seaweed is quite a phenomenal food. This is one of the foods that are constantly and continuously harvested today. Well, not constantly, but we're getting toward it. It's probably the way the weather's been heating up a bit. It's reducing the harvestability of seaweed, and it makes it go rotten sooner on the rocks. This is a picture of the typical kind of range of vessels. The most typical is this. This. That same boat that's sitting there is owned by the band itself, and it's used more as a transportation vessel. And occasionally, it's leased out, or the licenses are leased out to somebody, typically not anymore from the community. And then you see some smaller commercial boats up there, where the gilneters. There's about six or seven gilneters left. But this is the contemporary fleet. What it looks like, and it's mostly in the small, either open or partially covered category. So here's Pensema. two things to note. First, this gigantic region. That's more than half of the BC coast. That was supposed to form some kind of integrated marine area for planning. And you have a host of different First Nations, a host of different commercial utilizations. Though I would say that in terms of the commercial utilization of this space, this kind of large area sort of makes sense. Because the commercial fleets today operate on these larger regions in terms of where people are fishing, how they're operating. For the First Nations communities, this is not the way in which this area is envisioned or understood. The other interesting thing about the way Pensema was set up, now it was set up under the Liberal government before the Conservatives came in. It operated and was actually done by the Department of Fisheries and Ocean. And then for a while when the Conservatives were in a minority government, it continued along. As soon as it became a majority government, essentially the funding got pulled. And one of the reasons the federal government was concerned is that the private sector environmental NGOs were involved in funding it, and they said these people basically have a hidden agenda. And you can track this, it's all in the public domain, these kind of comments and their concerns. But what was interesting about this, if you see this governance committee here, so here's the federal departments, the Pacific Interdepartmental Oceans Committee, this is all the different government agencies and ministries. Over here you have individual First Nations, and they're supposed to form regional groupings, and then they had representatives from the regional groupings, and they sat on the PNCMA First Nations Governance Committee, which you see over here, you see the parallel structure, federal government, the different ministries going to here, the bilateral coordination between First Nations and the Crown. Then you had the steering committee, which was half and half, First Nations and federal representatives, the secretariat, which basically was the staff that were hired it, and then down here, and this is really what irked the commercial fishing industry, as well as the recreational sector, stakeholder engagement. So it was kind of a novel thing, because what the federal government was actually trying to put into play was a government-to-government structure right off the bat for planning this. And then when they got, it did irk some of the, commercial fishing industry quite strenuously. But the federal government, I guess it was 2013, somewhere around there, decided that they weren't going to fund it. They basically dialed it right back and turned it into a completely an in-house DFO thing. They got rid of all the contract staff they'd hired to work with this area. It was right on the period of time when they were closing Department of Fisheries and Oceans licenses, selling research stations, and essentially massively downscaling the science side of the federal government's research. And for some reason, which is always curious, the provincial government decided to get engaged in marine planning. And so they had an agreement between some First Nations and themselves, the provincial government, and started to say, well, we're going to create some plans. Now, I'm just going to run quickly through these questions. They're relevant, but not the key point I want to get at. I'm going to move to show you the template between the provincial government or the government planning process and what Kikala's idea. Yeah?
Is this only for oceans, or is this something to do with like oceans
and
stuff?
This is only oceans from the foreshore intertidal area. So where the provincial government said that they could actually kind of latch on was in the foreshore, which is provincial jurisdiction. And so anything like that fixes the land. So they also, the provincial government they're the ones that license aquaculture facilities because they're anchored to the bottom. Even though the federal government regulates fish farming in a certain sense in terms of some of the fish aspect of it, the site licenses are provincial. Same with a lot of the oyster farming, things like that, the shellfish farming. So when I say it was perplexing, this is probably the reason that it was important for the provincial government to try to create this kind of marine planning, because they need a consultative process to free the foreshore, docks development, aquaculture, etc. So when Kikala picked this up, they had this series of questions they wanted to know. So what did people want to use for the territory? What's the vision of marine use? What are areas that need protection, etc. This is a series of ideas. And then also the idea of what wouldn't be allowed in the territories, who would be permitted in, who would be excluded from this area. Just in a straight, direct comparison, if you look at any regime, take a look at the European Union's agreement for their fisheries policy, they actually have nation-to-nation agreements. EU, the so-called the Great Common Blue Pool, where all fishing nations go, but different nations participating in the common fisheries area of the European Union have different rights. So there's exclusions and inclusions. But here's what the template, and this is a standard one. You can just Google planning template, any whatever. that basically, here's the temple. This is what the province said. Okay, we're going to do this. This is what we want you to, you know, essentially fill in the blanks. We want to define cultural areas, food protection areas, i.e. zones that are only going to be for harvest of food, areas that need to be repaired, notions about protection areas, special types of habitat like eelgrass, which is a big, always a big one. Because of course, it's a rearing zone for juvenile, for larval fish and juvenile fish. Areas for scientific research, conservation areas, no-take zones. It's a big thing right now. Marine protected area, no-take zones. It's being pushed. Sadly, to be quite honest, you need such a large no-take zone for these things to be biologically feasible that it raises a question about them. I mean, some fishing communities actually see them as kind of concentration areas, and you just fish around the edges. So the problem is, if you create a marine protected area around a relatively mobile fish species, all it does is kind of gives them a kind of a safe zone, and then you just wait outside the edge and catch them. And then the discussion becomes, well, do we put a buffer zone around the MPA? And that's great. All you're doing is kind of extending it. It's like, how far do you have to extend it? On land-based parks, the research has shown that patchwork parks don't work. You need contiguous space. You need large area mass. In fact, the 12% that's used as the guide in British Columbia for land-based parks, conservation areas, is really too small on the work that's done. If you truly want to maintain a kind of zone that preserves the diversity within that area, marine spaces are pretty much the same. Some species are more contained and don't move around as much. And then these different areas, you know, the other different areas, these are all part of the template. Well, here's the Kakatla model. A little bit different. Table of contents, different approach. Site Gulumgut, beginning with the point we are all of one heart, that we all share a commonality, a common connection, and this is documented through the social relations between people and with it, and between people and non-human beings. Ayok, then, is the law, following with the law that regulates how people engage in practicing and harvesting. Vidak is the history that establishes the way that law and then documents the particular distribution in the placement of these resources on the land and starts talking about the territorial definitions of the places. Gogokliants is the idea of inheritance, of passing forward the notion that there are people who are trained to take on the mantle of management, as well as there are benefits or goods that need to be preserved to go forward. And then Yalk, which is feast or celebration, to recognize how this is then manifest through law, through practice, through social relations. A completely different model. You can hear the echoes of the classic marine planning thing resonating through this and some of the similarities, but it completely picks it up and reforms and reshapes the idea of marine planning, and at its fundamental root is the idea that Kakatla has the authority and jurisdiction to do this. Therein lies the rub. There is the contradiction, because of course the Crown does not think that, and the documents went back and forward, back and forward, back and forward, because of course the part of the contract with the provincial government was this group of First Nations had to translate everything into one common document that fit the template there. Fitting that to this is very difficult, especially when some of the ways in which you enact it look like this. So of course, these plans always, like, you don't just go from the grand principles, you've got to move down, you've got to have a goal, you have an objective, and then you have a mechanism to achieve that that goal. So, recognition of Kakatla authority over Kakatla territory. So what's the objective? What's the objective that's tied to that particular goal? Expand Kakatla monitoring enforcement, and the strategies or the techniques to do that. We're going to create a guardian program, a Department of Fisheries, as it were. We're going to have the devolution of authority from DFO to Kakatla, so Kakatla is actually in charge of enforcing and making the responsibilities. Then some details about how you have to buy boats, get some materials, even get a logo for flags and deck health. And then the physical infrastructure on the ground. So all this would be great. Typically, the government plan might say, goal, capacity building. Objective, expand Kakatla monitoring and enforcement capacity. And then they would might say some of the same strategies. Except that subtle shift is a fundamental shift in direction and understanding. Because as soon as you shift from recognition of rights and title, which leads to direct authority and power and decision, to enhancing and building capacity building, what you're talking about is now we're going to help you become better. I'm going to build your capacity so you can be a better monitor and you can enforce the Crown's rules more effectively. Kikatla says, no, this is about our lands, our territories, our waters. We want your resources, because you owe them to us, to be able to affect that and to do this. And that actually is, even though it might look like it's a fundamental shift, and it becomes a problem because sometimes the negotiators for the Crown don't necessarily get this subtle difference. And so they're happy with it. And then very often a lawyer somewhere back upstream looks at the document and says, you actually can't agree to this. We have to go back, and back the document comes, all redlined and track changed back to the way it was where it says capacity building, for example. And so this is the back and forth, and ultimately at the end of the day, until you actually address that fundamental problem, we're going to have these difficulties. At the same time, these kind of documents where you have these sort of side-by-side differences of perspective and interpretation with very much the same internal content allow for the capacity for building in the spaces and the gaps within the dominance of the mainstream system an alternative model of governance and control that, if it can be cultivated and grown, will actually shift the mainstream and actually lead to a kind of change in the regime of control that we currently operate under. So that's where we'll end today. Thanks. Thank you.